York, 99.5 FM. My name is Bill Samuels, founder of NYPeoplesConvention.org. WBAI is New York's leader in progressive talk. Whether the issue is prison reform, education reform, the legalization of marijuana, or women's rights, the people's issues are covered on these airways. So stay tuned for the best in leading-edge progressive ideas and analysis. And remember to support independent media financially.
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now even when things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song.
Oh, sing it, Jimmy boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you'll even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them, a million of them. Now you know that, so you can't go wrong.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
You start off each day with a song. You've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft, soft, a little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeon. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented. I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me. I ups to him, and without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail. I lands on his head. He flips his head. I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then, the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing, south to the border, down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved. And the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and their kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that, so you can't go wrong.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
If you start off each day with a song.
Well, Jimmy Durante, thank you. You provide a sense of normalcy and continuity in my life. As my froggy, allergetic voice seems to be croaking. Here on Saturday morning, I'm David Rothenberg. The name of the program is Any Saturday. We're on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, and I'm here with you for a couple of hours, and hopefully we can consume a couple of hours, and well, we're not going to totally ignore that our shot lives have been reshaped, but we can find some avenues of hope and humor, perhaps. I have a guest in the second hour I'm looking forward to talking to. Actually, we've been on the phone and emailing. He's the former governor of Alabama, Don Siegelman, the only statewide elected Democrat last decade of the 20th century in the state of Alabama. His story is incredible. It's going to be the first of a few interviews that we're going to be having with him over the next couple of months, because his story is extraordinary. and he is. So I hope you stay tuned till then. So what is my life like? Well, many people, 23 hours a day inside. I'm not one of. I'm retired, so I'm not one of the people that are out there doing God's work, helping the city move along. I'm inside 23 hours a day, but I've discovered that my life has changed somewhat. For example, how is it altered, David? Please tell us. Okay, I will. I've been doing something that I haven't done since I was in the Army, and that is washing my socks and underwear in the bathroom sink. Can't get any place else to have it clean, so there I am. I remembered how to do it, because in the Army, we did it either in the showers or in the sink. Just scrub away at the socks and underwear and keep it clean. We become very enterprising. I've also, I've become an electronic genius. I participate in Fortune Society's 3 staff meetings a week by Zoom. I actually have, with much help and a lot of consternation, have learned how to participate in group meetings with Zoom. I never thought, you know, I thought making toast was my greatest accomplishment, and here I am. Probably the most emotional thing that happens to me, and it's been 4 nights that I've done it, is going. I'm a couple of blocks away from an emergency health center in the Village, where I live, Greenwich Village in Manhattan. And a week ago Friday night, I could hear all the fire engines out there, and I thought, oh, that's the last thing we need is a fire in the health center. But they quickly departed. The next night they came again, and I thought, oh, there's a crank wasting the time of the firemen. And on the third night when they came, I went downstairs, and I said, what's going on? And I walked across the street and down the block, and there the firemen were paying homage to the healthcare workers, and people started applauding. There were about 50 people spread around a block distance from the emergency center, and then people were opening their windows and shouting, and trumpets were blowing. And I've gone downstairs every night now. It is so beautiful. The health workers come out and they wave, and the people in the area applaud, and then now, I think last night in the chilled air, there are a couple of hundred people, not close to each other, spread around 2 blocks across the street, down the block, people opening their windows, and it's just stunning to watch the appreciation. And of course, I've learned that it's happening around the city and hopefully around the country. The firemen have always been heroes to me. And they're heroic, and they lead it, and they send up the flag at 7. And if you're near a center, a hospital or a healthcare facility, and that's happening, and you can get out and join them, you'll find it inspiring, and it gives. I can't even express all the emotions. It gives me a sense of being a part of something much bigger than the virus. It gives me a feeling that people can care, no matter the circumstances, and very hopeful. So that's what I'm going to do at 7 o'clock tonight, and as long as I can, and as long as the fire trucks come, and as long as we're enduring this invasion of the Godzilla virus. And Sean, engineer, who's bravely in the studio, one of the heroes at WBAI who goes in, the rest of us broadcasting from home. I used to just nod to him and he'd play the song. Now I have to say, Sean, Harry Connick, if you will.
you come home, I cried the whole night long. I do the cooking barely, I pay the rent. I know I've done you wrong. Remember that rainy evening I threw you out with nothing but a fine tooth comb. I know I'm to blame. Ain't that a shame? Dear Belly, won't you please come home?
That song was written by Traditional, according to the CD, and a man named Huey Cannon wrote lyrics to it, and that was arranged by the vocalist piano player, Harry Connick Jr. I may have explained to you last week how this works. I'm in my palatial mansion in Greenwich Village, and on Fridays I email Sean, engineer, Sean Rhodes, I email him the selection of records, and someone, sometime, has made it possible. I don't know what, how they've done it. Every recording ever made since time began is, well, I don't know how it's done. But he presses the, he dabbles with the computer and up comes Harry Connick's voice. And that's how it works. And I have no idea how it's done. Not a clue. Did I wish everyone a happy holiday? People are observing Passover and Easter, and this is usually a time of family and community, and so we've improvised. I've been told about Easter service, Easter services on Zoom and Seders on Zoom, and modern technology has made it possible in the midst of everything else for people to get together, at least getting a peek. When I've done the Zoom, it's very comforting seeing people. You know, one of the things I thrive on are hugs, and being affiliated with a place like the Fortune Society, where I'm not sure if it would pass muster with me too, but we're a hugging group of people, and I miss my hugs. But just seeing the folks who are huggable and huggies, it's nice to see, so I'm happy about that. We're raising money. Isn't that a surprise? We're WBAI. We're listener-sponsored. Money is tight at BAI and everywhere else. But if you think we're important enough to stick around during this crisis, become a buddy. What you do is pledge $15 to $20, and then every month it'll be put on your account. And as I've said in the past, when I've done it, you put in $15 or $20, and when you get your credit card bill, you hardly notice it because of all the other things that you spent. But if 400 or 500 people listening to this program did it, did $15, just multiply 500 times 15, and you have a radio station that's saved. So if you're so inclined, you can call us at 516-620-3602. Or if you want to fool around with that machine, the computer, you go to give2wbai.org. And that's the number to give2wbai.org, 516-620-3602. Or if you don't want to do the buddy thing, just call in and give us $1,000, and we'd be very happy about it. I also want to remind you that I started doing podcasts for the Fortune Society before we all were separated from each other. And you can the second one I is a repeat of a show I did on BAI several years ago. The program that I'm most, I shouldn't say most proud, but of which I am have great pride, because I think it has significance and it has had an impact on a lot of people. It's an interview I did with Two Men at Fortune, Barry Campbell and Casimiro Torres, who are both systems babies raised by the state. And it's one of the most insightful discussions that I've heard. Most of the talking by Barry and Kaz, I just asked the questions about cause and effect of crime and alienation of young people. So if you're podcast inclined, you can go to Spotify or iTunes or Apple, then go to Inside Fortune and ask for Systems Babies, and there you got it. It's isn't it interesting how all of that works? I, as I've said, I don't understand any of it. Oh, I know what I failed to tell you. I got a cell phone. Joanne Page at Fortune Society said, in the midst of this, you never know what crisis comes along. So I was probably the last American holdout. I don't know if I told you this, that several weeks ago, there was a teenage intern at Fortune, and she was helping on the first podcast. I was calling it pot roast for a while, on the first podcast. And she said if she needed something, she'd call me, "What's my cell phone number?" And I told her I didn't have one. And she looked at me as if she had met her first alien. She was from a generation that didn't know people, that didn't have cell phones. She said, "How do you talk to people?" And I said, "Well, I'm talking to you now. But what if they want to call you?" I said, "I go home and answer the phone there." She said, "That's cool." I think she thought I was on the it was a new wave. I was so far out. Isn't that funny? Interesting. All right, do we want some more music? Sarah Vaughan's on deck. This is a number she did. It's by H. Gillespie and J.B. Coots. She's on a CD with the Count Basie band. And whenever you hear popular singers from that period, Sinatra, Tony Bennett, Sarah Vaughan, I think Joe Williams, and this is the Basie band, that's them at their best. So here's Sarah Vaughan at her best with the Basie band.
And I find you are spinning around in my brain, like the bubbles in a glass of champagne. You go to my head like a sip of sparkling burgundy. And I find the very mention of you like the kicker in a julep or two. ever thought that you might give a thought to my plea, cast a spell over me. Still I say to myself, get a hold of yourself. Can't you see that it never can be? Like a summer with a thousand Julys, you intoxicate my soul with your eyes. Though I'm certain that this heart of mine hasn't a ghost of a chance. You go to my head. You go to my head. The thrill of the thought that you might give a thought to my plea, cast a spell over me. Still I say to myself, get a hold of yourself. Can't you see that it never can be? You go to my head with a smile that makes my temperature rise, like a summer with a thousand Julys. You intoxicate my soul with your eyes. Of a chance in this crazy, crazy, crazy romance. You go to my head, you go to my head, you go to my head.
Sarah Vaughan. I was a big fan of Sarah's in her early days. As the years, decades went on, she overinterpreted lyrics, and I'm a big cheerleader for good lyric interpretation, and so she lost me in the last years of her career. But early Sarah, pretty special. So I'm not watching as much television as I thought I would be. I watched The View and then Andrew's, Governor Cuomo's Daily Report. Maybe at night I'll check in reruns of Golden Girls or basketball games, or if there's a good TCM movie, so Annie Hall and Manhattan the other night, and that was good. And an excellent picture I never heard of. They did an evening of Harry Belafonte movies, and he did a picture with Zero Marcel called Angel Levine. Never heard of it. It's not perfect. It's a flawed picture. But one of those wonderfully flawed movies with a lot of cameos by people you almost recognize. And I always liked Belafonte as a singer, as a performer, and he was good in Carmen Jones. It's probably the most successful movie. But I was impressed at his acting chops in this movie and the pas de deux, the theatrical pas de deux he did with Zero Marcel was beautiful. he's an angel. He plays a street guy who hits Earth and is assigned to help this man whose wife is in bad health. The man is Zero, and Harry Belafonte's name in it is Angel Levine. Very, very good performance and a pretty good picture. So I don't watch, I try to avoid any appearance of Trump, although I get the recap on CNN of his press conference. I cannot abide by his lengthy, wandering press conferences. When I did see it, he stumble mumbles as he reads what he's been assigned to read, and then he goes off. And it's chilling. This week, I gather, and I've read about it as well, he's gone after the World Health Organization. I have no idea of how good they are, or if they've been helpful in the crisis. I'm not conversant with the World Health Organization, but he says that they had it wrong. This is from a man who called it a hoax, called the pandemic a hoax 5 weeks ago. He spends so much time blaming and pointing fingers and accusing and demeaning others. And if anybody in his circumference hints that he's less than perfect, they're fired, accused, called a name. It's the quintessential bully, and to have him at the stern during this pandemic is pretty scary for me. I also want to note, as we're doing the Trump roundup, Nikki Haley had a former governor of South Carolina, former representative to the United Nations. She had an op-ed piece in the Times yesterday, and I thought, oh, she's back again, because, you know, I've been suggesting that I think that Trump is going to dump. This is just a political guess on my part. I have no evidence. It's my being a political groupie. If I was advising Trump, I'd tell him to resign. But if I were one of his faithful puppy dogs, I would probably say dump Pence, get Nikki Haley, woman. I wouldn't call her a woman of color. I'd call her a beige. She's of Indian extraction. She's and that might pull some votes in, because it's all about, for him, it's all about votes. He doesn't like governing. He loves campaigning. He loves the rallies. He loves the affirmation of the stranger, the telling him that he's not as terrible as he really is. During the week, acting Navy Secretary resigned. Thomas Motley, after an outbreak on an aircraft carrier, Theodore Roosevelt, was canned because of his concerns. Subsequently, 400 cases yesterday were announced. 400 cases of the virus were announced on the ship that he was alerting people about, but he was canned. There was a changing of the guard of the press secretaries. You know who they are. They're the ones that used to come out and do press conferences, Sarah Huckabee. And we were so happy to get rid of her. And then she had a woman named Stephanie Graham replaced her, and we never saw her. Stephanie Graham is not eligible in the future for Famous Fleeting because no one ever knew her to begin with. She was she's the vanishing press secretary, replaced by a 31-year-old woman who was a CNN reporter whose name is Kaylee McEnary, McEnary, but Kaylee, this is the clue, Kaylee is spelled K-A-Y-L-E-I-G-H. That already, spelling Kaylee with a G-H, already puts her on the outside with B. Brian Miller's been made inspector general. He's in charge of a $500 million bailout fund. He's a... Well, we'll go into that a little later. There's a change with the Pentagon inspector who will oversee the virus relief fund. Well, that's he also is threatening. It's not really a threat. He's suggesting. Remember, we were going to open the churches and everything by Easter. Now he's saying by the end of the month, and he's so excited about the stock market has had its best week in 45 years after dropping It's worse since the Depression. But with his eye on the stock market, and that it did rise, and that's good news, I guess, it was announced that 10 million people were unemployed, that it reached 10 million. He never, well, I don't watch the press conference. Did he discuss that? He seems to be happy about the stock market bouncing, but and I don't know why the stock market bounces up. Because I remember during more normal times, if there's a report that there's 200,000 new jobs found, the stock market would get a bump. Wouldn't you think that an announcement of 10 million unemployed people would affect the stock market? Who are those people? At the stock market, I'm talking about. And who is that person in the White House? And why do I get chills when I think of him? He's also set the tone for idiocy around the country. Have you read about the Texas doctor who has filed a lawsuit in Houston saying he says staying at home against places of worship, that it's God's given right to assemble to worship? Why would you want to put people who you are ostensibly in charge of and who you should be loving, to put them in a dangerous situation? Why would you want to go to court? Of course, people of faith want to get back into church, but most priests, ministers, rabbis, I forget about the Orthodox Jews, most people want to protect the people that they have a spiritual responsibility to and separate them from each other, so that they can get back, be alive, and come back and assemble again and worship as they did in the past. So many convoluted thinking. All right, a little musical transition. As you may know, I'm crazy about Peggy Lee, who I worked with for many years and who became fond of, but before I even worked with her, I was such a fan of hers. And I discovered a song that I had never heard of that she had recorded. And it is so appropriate to play right now. Listen to the lyrics. She wrote this. Peggy Lee.
Don't cry. There'll be another spring. I know our hearts. Is on the wing. Another time to love and laugh with me. Just wait and see.
George Shearing on the piano. Isn't that interesting? A song that you probably, I hadn't heard it. I may have a lovely little ballad. And suddenly you listen to the lyrics and it has a poignancy that you never would suspect. There will be another spring. And in case you didn't know it, I'm David Rothenberg and you are listening to WBAI, listener sponsored radio, 99.5 FM in the, in New York City. And I, around this time, not specifically at this time, I do an essay which I call Out on a Limb, which will be followed by some Barry White music. Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams called for a response to statistics that revealed African Americans are disproportionately succumbing to the coronavirus. How do you undo centuries-old systemic racism in the midst of a pandemic? Housing, schools, jobs, modes of transportation are cemented in our divided society. The virus germ doesn't look for people of color. It finds folks in congested locations, neighborhoods, subways, and thrives in poverty. Poverty and racism are partners in America's historic charade. And in the midst of this spotlighted nightmare, announcements are coming from the White House that those in charge of money to be spent in an unprecedented $2 trillion stimulus package will now be in the hands of Trump's puppy dogs, professionals replaced by political lackeys. There's a new inspector general in charge of the $500 billion bailout for business. The new Pentagon inspector will oversee the virus relief fund. Those dismissed are experienced professionals. The new temps are Trump lapdogs without experience in the arena, but probably veterans of political campaigns. My conclusion, and this is one of my political assessments, no charts, no polls, assessments that sometimes irritate a few listeners, like my suggestion a few months back that Joe Biden had a better shot than Bernie Sanders in defeating Trump. I wasn't endorsing Biden. I just thought he had, for lots of reasons, which I gave then, an issue which we argued about for a few weeks before life and death consumed our daily routine and the Democratic nomination was put on the back burner. We'll get to it again in the future. My grave concern about Trump's revolving door of assignments during the health crisis, pandemic, is that his Cocker Spaniels will not be heeding the genuine concerns of black leaders, but will have their eyes on November rather than April, and money will be disproportionately pumped into battleground states. This is a political assessment on my part. It's not fact. The frequently identified Iowa, Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Florida will be the, in my estimation, will the most visible recipients of stimulus money disproportionately in the middle of a pandemic and you at a time when you can't unravel systemic racism, segregated schools, neighborhoods, and job opportunities, if probed and altered, might come about as a result of this Godzilla crisis, but not soon enough to save lives this month. My last subway ride to WBAI, this station, I'm home situated now, was about a month ago, as it always was on a Saturday morning about 6:30 in the cars in early March, as they are during all cold months, were filled with homeless men, mostly black and Hispanic and clearly in various degrees of bad health. You could hear a month ago I said I can't ride the subways anymore because we were just becoming aware of the health crisis, or 5 weeks ago it was, we're just becoming aware of it, and the men were hacking coughs and of concern. And they were mostly black and Hispanic, and how many have those survived this epidemic will never be documented, though we're hearing about unclaimed bodies being put, being buried in Potter's Field, and I wouldn't, if although there'll be no documentation because these are people without families, I am sure that people who we saw riding the subways, homeless on the streets, are high in that category of unclaimed bodies being buried in Potter's Field. But they were on the subways where people who do work travel from home to the job every day and have continued to do that. And you don't need to be a social scientist to recognize that those subways were one starting point in the city being the nation's epicenter of the epidemic, and that the large number of black virus patients who emerged from that, because many New Yorkers with an apartment and a laptop can work from home and avoid mass transportation, but the healthcare workers, the supermarket employees, the mass transit and postal workers can't stay home and have to travel by subway or bus, and their lives put them in constant contact with the world at large. I'm retired, inside 23 hours a day, 3 walks a day with mask and gloves on, safe as anyone, but constantly reminded because of my age that I'm high risk. But I'm in a position where I can avoid high risk situations. Everyone does not have that luxury or that advantage. And this shouldn't be a time for horizontal hostility. Those who can find safety must and should. But others in more vulnerable locations must be identified and protected, tested, so their lives are not on the line every time they leave the house. If their house is not a place of concern with 6 or 8 or 10 people living in an apartment. Eric Adams' trumpet call is real and vital, but there is no satisfactory response today. It's work probably for the future, for young men particularly, young black men, more time and money directed at education and vocational opportunities rather than big bucks spent on jails and prisons. We've been bellowing about that societal dead end for years, and I've been witness to young men of color who come to places like the Fortune Society who have been written off, and watch them come back and see the potential and their contributions to society, and not to make the most advantage of them is so self-defeating for the total society. This is not a time, though, for giving up. Rather, it's a clarion call for digging in. Taking to the streets is noisy and discomforting with a short-range impact, but it does provide awareness. The real change, the real work, the need for societal alternatives is a lifetime effort, not a release of tension by throwing a brick. Read Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Cesar Chavez, not only read what they had to say, but look at what their lives were. The blueprint is there, and it will outlive the virus. The virus strikes people of all colors and ages, and that should be the link to see how the evils of poverty and racism has a rippling effect on everyone. This is the starting point for meaningful change. For those who outlive the coronavirus, that's your mandate. I'm David Rothenberg, out on a limb. Every time I hear Barry White, I want to say, work on your lower register. It's not deep enough. It's quite a unique voice, and there's no mistaking Barry White. The CD does not give attribution to who wrote it, so I can't give the music and the composer and lyricist, but I'm sure someone wrote it. And on a lighter note, I received a communication through that strange machine called the computer, and someone suggested that Broadway musicals, if they were created during the pandemic, would have different titles. And they sent me some that I thought were very amusing, and then I added my own. So here's some of the shows that might open during a pandemic, like what we're going through now. Don't Kiss Me, Kate, The Sound of Mucus, No Company, Damn Hankies, The Little Shop of Horrors, An American Quarantined in Paris, A Gentleman's Guide to Hand Washing, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Pharmacy, No More Sundays in the Park with George, and then these are mine that I added. Come Back Little Sheba, but Get Tested First, Annie, Get a Gun and a Mask, Where's Charlie, and Tell Him to Stay There, Tony and Tina's Wedding is Canceled, The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas is Closed, Fiddler is Social Distancing on the Roof, and Take Me Along to the Apex. If you have your own ideas for Broadway shows, I am reachable at, well, I have two emails that I can get at home now. Try this one. It's faster. drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. I can get somebody arrange it so I can get both. I have two different emails, one at home, one at Fortune Society, and I can get both messages simultaneous at here. So if you have any shows that you think could be retitled DPR Fortunate, no, drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. Next song is from the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical Flower Drum Song, and I want to tell you, back in the day when shows like that opened, if you would go into restaurants and bars, all of which had jukeboxes, that you'd hear songs that were not yet heard in the Broadway show. That they, people like Rodgers and Hammerstein, their new shows had popular singers recording it, so that by the time the show opened, you know, the show would go to Boston and Philadelphia and New Haven, and by the time it came to New York, you were familiar with the hit songs. Hey There from Pajama Game was a perfect example. But Pat Suzuki singing I Enjoy Being a Girl and Flower Drum Song was a hit. Everybody was singing that before Flower Drum Song opened. But here is the original. And Pat Suzuki from the Broadway cast of the Rodgers and Hammerstein Flower Drum Song.
I'm a girl, and by me that's only great. I am proud that my silhouette is curvy, that I walk with a sweet and girlish gait, with my hips kind of swivelly and swervy. I adore being dressed in something frilly. When my date comes to get me at my place, out I go with my Joe or John or Billy, like a filly who is ready for the race. When I have a brand new hairdo with my eyelashes all in curl, I float as the clouds on air do. I enjoy being a girl. When men say I'm cute and funny, and my teeth aren't teeth but pearl, I just flap it up like honey. I enjoy being a girl. I flip when a fella sends me flowers. I drool over dresses made of lace. I talk on the telephone for hours with a pound and a half of cream upon my face. I'm strictly a female, female, and my future I hope will be we were. It goes to my head like brandy. I enjoy being a girl. When someone with eyes that smolder says he loves every silken curl that falls on my ivory shoulder, I enjoy being a girl. When I hear a complimentary whistle that greets my bikini by the sea, I turn and I glower and I bristle, but I'm happy to know the whistle's meant for me. I'm strictly a female, female, and my future I hope will be in the home of a brave and a free male who'll enjoy being a guy, having a girl like me.
Pat Suzuki, she and Miyoshi Yumiki, who you might, if you are a movie buff, Miyoshi Yumiki, you might recall, was the Academy Award-winning actress opposite Red Buttons in Sayonara. And they were the two lead females in this, along with Juanita Hall. And Ed Kenney and Larry Blyden were the men. Larry Blyden, I get a little misty-eyed when I talk about him. I had, it was a few years later, Larry and I, had been married to Carol Haney, the dancer from Pajama Game and one of Fosse's great dancers. Larry and I had become friends, and we saw each other at a party at my friend Gene Bach's. And I was leaving. He said, "I'll walk you home." And he said, "Listen, I'm leaving on vacation. I'm going away. I'm going to be in North Africa. But when I come back, we are long overdue for a dinner." And it never happened. He died in an accident in North Africa. And I always thought that I had a friendship that was blossoming that never happened. So anyway, after we hear the next song, we're going to be talking with the former governor of Alabama, Don Siegelman, who's I finished reading the advance copy of his book. His autobiography, Stealing Our Democracy, is not coming out until June, and we'll be talking with him again then about the specifics of his case. We're going to be talking about a lot of other things now, but I want you to know that he, what made him so significant in the state of Alabama, he was the only Democrat who won statewide elections. He was Secretary of State from 79 to 87. He was the Attorney General from 87 to 91, the Lieutenant Governor from 95 to 99, and the Governor from 99 to 2003. And he became the target of Karl Rove, all of which comes out in the autobiography. The story is chilling. We'll be getting to that at a later date. I want to introduce you to the governor. I'm talking about a lot of other things when he joins us after. His introduction is going to be an appropriate number from Judy Collins.
As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill lofts gray, are touched with all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people hear us singing, bread and roses, bread and roses. As we go marching, marching, we battle too for men, for they are women's children, and we mother them again. Our lives shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses.
Every time I hear Judy Collins and the Carls singing that, I want to find Emma Goldman, Cesar Chavez, or Bayard Rustin and just march with them. You're tuned to WBAI 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored radio in New York City. I'm David Rothenberg, and joined on the phone by Governor Don Siegelman of Alabama. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, David. Glad to be with you.
Nice to have you. You know, let me start off by saying this. Naive as we Yankees are, when I think of Alabama politics, I think of George Wallace, Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions, and when I read your soon-to-be-released, but not yet, autobiography, to find out that your first political hero was Allard Lowenstein, that you were on the board of directors of the ADA, and one of your close friends was the Reverend Shuttlesworth, who was Dr. King's partner in many of the marches. So how does... Tell us, who are you?
Well... That's a good question. I was raised by two wonderful parents. I was blessed in that regard. My mother was sort of the religious rock of the family, Catholic. My father had, his grandfather was Jewish, and hence the name Sigelman. And my dad was interested in politics, was of course, FDR and John Kennedy supporter, and was anti-Wallace. And so we had many kitchen table discussions. He was not active in politics at all, but just an astute observer. But my mother helped prepare me for public service by, I remember one day we were walking in downtown Mobile, and she said, "See that old lady over there on the corner? Why don't you go ask her if you can help her cross the street?" So, and I did, and when we crossed the street, my mother said, "Well, how did that feel?" And I said, "Well, you know," and I didn't quite understand what she was trying to get at, but she was trying to teach me that, you know, doing good deeds is more than just words, that you have to put action behind it. And I had another experience which was really profound. And when I was in high school, I was organizing charitable projects for my high school fraternity. And one of the things we did, we took people with disabilities, children with disabilities, to a state fair. And I carried this young lady who was in a wheelchair, but the wheelchair couldn't go through the mush of the wet sawdust. And we rode some rides, but it was an experience that has never left me. And it touched my heart that I had made someone else happy that day. Anyway, going from there to the anti-war movement, I was swept up and disturbed and profoundly opposed to the war in Vietnam, and had the good fortune of being at the National Student Congress in the University of Maryland, where I met Allard Lowenstein and signed a letter as president of the student body, incoming president of the student body at the University of Alabama, to end the war. And he got in touch with me some months later. Not much later, weeks later, to say that he was coming through Alabama to going to Mississippi and wanted to know if I wanted to pick him up at the airport and drive him to Jackson rather than him flying over. And I took him up on that offer. And that was the beginning of a short lifelong friendship, because Allard, of course, was assassinated in 1980.
But, Governor, he was the ultimate progressive at the time, and there you were in Alabama, which was considered politically Wallace territory. It didn't seem like it would be the starting juncture for a successful political career to be identified with Allard Lowenstein going to Mississippi. Didn't you meet with Charles Evers, Medgar's brother, while you were there?
Oh, yeah, well, we met with, at the time, this was in 67, going towards 68, the Chicago Convention, and Allard was trying to put together a coalition delegation of Democrats in Mississippi. Those, you know, African Americans largely committed to LBJ, but Al was looking for delegates who would vote for a peace candidate. And that was our first foray. The last one was to the inauguration of Charles Evers as mayor of Fayette, Mississippi. And then I did a little work in his campaign for governor in 1971 when Charles Evers ran for governor, first African-American, I guess, to run for governor in Mississippi. But Al and I became, as you know, I was enamored by his powerful, passionate speeches, and he was such an amazing, charismatic character to watch and to listen to and be around. And particularly during those days, you know, when we were, you know, struggling with our conscience about the war and what, you know, as young people, what we were going to do. I looked at Canada, looked at the possibility of declaring myself a conscientious objector. And a friend of mine at school said, you know, Don, you've got a future in politics, but if you do this, you're going to end it. He said, my dad's a general in the Air National Guard. Why don't you go talk to him and maybe he can find you a spot? Well, he did, and I did. And one of the shocking things that I reveal in my book, Stealing Our Democracy, is when we got to Lackland Air Force Base, we got off the bus and we were standing at attention. This was June the 6th, the morning after the California primary, and
Bobby Kennedy.
We were standing at attention, and this officer walks up and he says, well, I've got some good news for you. That son of a bitch, Robert Kennedy, was killed last night. And my heart just dropped. I mean, here I was, anti-war. I had met Bobby Kennedy just months before when I was president of the student body. We had brought him to campus and sat next to him in a car when we drove him to the airport. And, you know, I was thinking, you know, months, I mean, the entire future of the country at that point was resting on the shoulders of Robert Kennedy. You know, he was the answer in our minds to, you know, bringing an end to the war and moving this country in the direction that it needed to go. And then suddenly his life, like Martin Luther King's and others, were snuffed out. And it was just a devastating moment. Anyway, I finished my short stint at Lackland Air Force Base and immediately went to New York to work in Al's campaign for Congress and stayed with him until he was gerrymandered out of his district in 1971. But we
that was an early lesson for you, wasn't it, in political machinations?
Oh, yes. And tell you another quick story that I describe in my book. When Al was defeated, well, drop back a little. After Kent State, another, you know, and of course, you know, the Jackson State in Mississippi, they were, you know, students killed there too, and Al wanted to have congressional hearings on police violence and National Guard excessive use of force, and we did. And in the course of that, we dealt with the Deputy Attorney General from Civil Rights at the Department of Justice, and when Al left office in 71, Al suggested I go over and talk to the deputy AG and see if I could get a job working in the criminal section of the Civil Rights Division, which I did as a law student. But before I could go to work, I had to have some income. So I went to my United States Senator, Jim Allen, who got me a job as a Capitol Hill policeman. I thought I was going to be, like, you know, working on elevators, you know, taking congressmen up and down the, you know, floors of the Longworth or Cannon or I don't even know if they had the Raymond building then. But anyway, the last day of our training, the captain of the Capitol Hill Police Force walks in and says, there's one thing we haven't told you. If someone kills one of your fellow officers, they don't get away. And he had a throwdown weapon. I don't remember whether he dropped it on the floor or just held it in his hand. But he said, you know, you have one of these, you have a knife or weapon, and you throw it down. And it's self-defense. You don't let them get away. But he was telling us how to kill someone. Anyway, in the basement of the Capitol of the United States, but Al was my single greatest political teacher in all kinds of ways. But the two things that stand out, learning how to organize and canvass and count votes when you're running for office, and the second thing that he taught me was how to speak, how to give a passion when you believed. If you believed in something strongly enough, you didn't need to worry so much about what the words were, because they were going to come out okay. And I guess in part that Al gave me the understanding that a single person can change things. We in 1970. 71, we created the National Youth Caucus, and he sent me from Florida to Washington State to Mississippi and to organize young people to support a peace candidate going into the 72 convention. But it was experiences like that that taught me that, hey, you know, you can do this. You can put things together that can change things. It can even change politics in the United States. So he gave
Governor, all of that is a strange background for someone who becomes governor of the state of Alabama with all of our preconceived notions. And at a future date, we're going to talk about all of that, about your governorship and what happened. But I also want to talk to you today about your incarceration, that while you were running for re-election, while you were running for governorship, and all the I'm not asking you to go into the details of that case. We'll do that in a few weeks. But okay. you were sent to prison, to a federal prison. So there are several things about that experience, and especially the fact that you were at Oakdale, which is one of the places that has been cited as a nightmare during the virus. And I love your insight on that. But, you know, one of the things I always hear, and you've probably heard it, is, oh, federal prisons, they go to a country club. And then reading your account, well, several things. One is when Roger Stone and that congressman from California got sentenced, the reports in the paper, well, they're going to report in 6 months to do their jail time. Well, where are they going? To the Yucatan for a vacation? When I read your book, when you were sentenced, the day in court, they shackled you right there, and you went into solitary confinement for 30 days before you ended up at Oakdale. One, I want to know about that part, and also what Oakdale was like and is like as a federal prison in which people are dying, apparently, right now.
Let me.
That's a long question.
Yeah, a long question, and it's a big jump. So I'm going to ask your listeners, if they are an Amazon member, you can download or you can watch a documentary on my case. It's called Atticus versus the Architect, and it's free on Amazon. But it'll give them a flavor of how we're jumping from governor to prison. But
we'll get back to the governorship in a couple of weeks when your book comes out.
Okay. I was handcuffed, shackled, and put in the back seat of a old van and taken to the worst prison in the United States, the oldest prison in Atlanta. And we were put into solitary confinement, and eventually, as you mentioned, after about 30 days, we ended up in Oakdale, Louisiana, which is the furthest place from my home that they could put me. 500 miles is the limit, and we were right at 500 miles in Oakdale. But there's a reason why more inmates have died in Oakdale than at any other facility in the United States. In fact, another inmate died overnight, so that the count now is six out of the nine inmates who have died nationally, at least by the latest FBOP report. Six of them have died in Oakdale. I got a report from an inmate this morning that 49 inmates are on ventilators, and you know, it's the prospects don't look.
That figure of nine, is that's federal prisons. That doesn't count state and city jails, does it?
Oh, yes, correct.
Nine federal prisons have died. So, describe the dorm that you went into, which had been a converted, television room or something?
It was a converted television room, and we called it the 21-man room because there were 21 men that stayed there. The bunk beds were stacked three on top, not two, and they were so close together that you could literally reach out and touch the bed next to you. There was no, the aisle going between bunk to bunk was so small that only one person could walk through there at a time. And when you got into your bed, the only thing you could do was lay down because there wasn't enough room to sit up. It nicknamed the submarine room because that's what it reminded people of, is living in a submarine. But the dorm itself, which is really nothing, as you know, but a warehouse. It's a cinder block building with a tin roof. Windows are shut. There's no ventilation. The doors are locked. And, you know, there's the only ventilation are two fans that blow dust and whatever else from one end of the dorm to the other. Well, they've cut those off now. But
did anyone get sick while you were there? And did it go through, like a cold, if somebody got a cold or a flu?
Well, we had an outbreak of staph infection, and
went through the whole place.
Everybody had to be extraordinarily careful. But you know, you didn't know who had it or what to stay away from, and everybody was sharing the same. You know, you had communal showers and using the same bar of soap and. The urinals are only inches away with no protection between the two. And there's a small room that's made for 40 people to eat, and we have, you know, 175 people there. So you can imagine how crowded I call it a cafeteria. I don't know what you'd call it, but, you know, a place with tables and stools and but there are only 40 people can get in there, and you're trying to feed 176 people. So it's very, very crowded, and that's what makes it particularly susceptible to something like this virus. But, the point I want to make on this discussion is, all right, the House Judiciary Committee, bless their souls, have put pressure on Barr last Friday, sent out an edict to the FBOP saying, you know, try to get these people out of here, low risk, nonviolent, pose no public safety risk. If they have at-risk conditions, health conditions, or if they're short-termers and can be sent home to home confinement, you know, let's do it. Well, the question that raises in my mind, and I want to raise in the minds of your listeners, is why are they there in the first place? If they pose no public safety risk, you know, we're spending over $2 billion a year on inmates, on prisons and guards and facilities and food for inmates. So if they don't need to be there, why are we keeping there? Let me give you one quick example that I write about in my book, Stealing Our Democracy. A guy named Juan Garcia I was working, writing, helping inmates every day on petitions and briefs and letters to judges. But this one inmate, I asked him, you know, why he was there. He gave me his papers. He had been arrested in 1994 on a half ounce of marijuana, felony on probation. 97, half ounce of marijuana or more, felony on probation. 1999, he gets picked up again. No amount of marijuana given, but he's arrested on a marijuana conspiracy, and he's careered out 25 years. He spent 19 years in federal prison for nothing. He was no danger to anybody.
19 years.
I want to say something about the Fortune Society, because
I got to ask you one more question about helping people in prison. Then I certainly won't lose what you have to say about Fortune. You discussed a case that you were helping a guy in jail with, and I brought it up to several people, and they said it couldn't be true. And that was, you said that at sentencing, the man was convicted of a crime, and when he was asked if he had anything to say, he said, "I am innocent." And the judge added 4 years, saying he committed perjury, because if he was found guilty, he couldn't be innocent.
It happens all the time. It's standard operating procedure.
That's extraordinary.
Let me just quickly say, the government gets 99% of the indictments they seek. That's a pretty good average, don't you think? Wouldn't you like to have that average if you were going to Las Vegas, winning 99% of the time? It's incredible. In fact, it is incredible. And the reason why they get 99% of the indictments is because they can present false evidence with impunity or withhold exculpatory evidence. And that's not made up stuff. The President of the United States, Barack Obama, sent his Solicitor General, Elena Kagan, into the United States Supreme Court January the 4th, 2010, to make the following argument, and I quote, "U.S. citizens do not have a constitutional right not to be framed." Now think about that. As citizens of the United States, the President of the United States is arguing you don't have a constitutional right not to be framed. The reason for that is the Federal Tort Claims Act gives prosecutors immunity from presenting false evidence. They can withhold exculpatory evidence, evidence that would tend to set someone free. Alex Krasinski, the chief judge of the Ninth Judicial Circuit, said that prosecutors withholding exculpatory evidence is epidemic in America. And going back to President Obama, when he was a senator, he proposed legislation which would help correct this by requiring that all interviews with witnesses and targets be recorded and those recordings turned over to the defense. That would do two things. It would give the defense evidence that someone's testimony had morphed over time, or it would be a deterrent from prosecutors trying to elicit false testimony. But I want to get back to your point. 99% of they get 99% of the indictments they seek. 97% plead guilty. Of the 3% that go to trial, if you testify on your own behalf and are found guilty, the judge can order and does usually order an additional penalty of perjury or obstruction of justice, because it is within their right to decide that you have lied to the jury in order to avoid conviction. Since the jury convicted you, you must have lied or you tried to obstruct justice.
It's painful. All right, now you were going to say Fortune Society. I wasn't going to lose that.
Well,
I know that when I said I wanted to send you material, you said, "David, we know all about Fortune Society."
Well, the Fortune Society is doing work that I to understand is necessary for inmates. If an inmate is going to be successful in returning to society, they have to have life skills. They have to have, of course, job skills. They have to have, you know, they have to be able to be able to read and write and communicate. And the Fortune Society is doing all of that and more. I want to give you another little story that I talk about in my book. I was walking toward the education trailer. It was just a small trailer
in Oakdale.
This African American gentleman, black gentleman, Mr. Williams, he's coming back from the trailer, and he's got an armful of books and things under his arms. And he said, "Governor," he said, "look what they gave me." He said, "look what they gave me." He said, "they know I can't read." You know, prison is not the best place to give people the skills that they need so that they won't return to prison, but it is society's last chance to make a difference in their lives. And it needs to be meaningful. These inmates need to be taught from the day they walk in. They need to be given the opportunity to learn life skills and reading skills and math skills and job skills. The only thing that they taught at Oakdale was how to be a welder. I mean, you know, you picked up other skills if you on your own. You could learn how to be a plumber on your own by working in that area and helping, you know, the dorm keep their urinals and toilets flushing and running, but
is Oakdale going to be closed during all this? You're getting reports every day. Is Oakdale going to be closed during this crisis, or are they keeping it open?
I don't know. They had a team in from Texas yesterday that were going through everybody's files, and they're probably making some quick decisions on who needs to be separated and where they need to go or where they can go. But, you know, the old saying, the wheels of justice turn slowly but when you're dealing with inmates, David, and you know this well, the wheels of justice are going to turn even more slowly because in this country, we have become accustomed to the lock them up and throw away the key mentality. We have it's been droned into our heads through Willie Horton ads and, you know, the debate with Michael Dukakis and George Bush decades.
Governor Seligman, matching that, talking about the wheels to justice moving slowly, can you share with our listeners, you had an appeal from, you were in Oakdale in Louisiana, and you were to be sent to Atlanta for a court hearing, a six-hour ride. Tell us how the wheels of justice moved then.
How
long did it take, and how many miles did you cover?
Interestingly, my lawyer at that time was Greg Craig of recent note. He was Obama's first White House counsel, and my other lawyer was another wonderful guy named Clifford Sloan, who had been deputy White House counsel under Clinton and special envoy to close Guantanamo under President Obama. We had an appeal, and we're going for hoping to get a new trial out of discovery. We had found evidence that the Department of Justice had written a letter to John Conyers explaining why my case was not political. But in that letter, they admitted that the lead prosecutor investigating my case was in email communication with my Republican opponent's campaign manager.
Now, Conyers was a congressman, head of a committee in D.C.
He was head of the House Judiciary Committee
right.
at the time. John Conyers from Detroit.
You're being sent to Atlanta for the hearing .
Yeah, and so my lawyers requested that they be allowed to pick me up at Oakdale and drive me to the court hearing and drive me back, which would have gotten me to Montgomery and back to Oakdale in less than 24 hours. But instead, the prosecutor objected, the warden objected, and that started my what turned out to be a 49-day journey. And by bus, by plane, by cars, going from Oakdale to Oklahoma City to Atlanta, from Atlanta to Montgomery, and
always shackled.
Always shackled, always handcuffed, and black box sometimes. You know, that the black box is where you can't move your hands at all. It's like, for...
So when I read that, I said, why? They could have gotten you there in 6 hours and one day, but they tortured you for 49 days. Is the answer they do it because they can? Is there any logic?
And it's not their money. You know, it's taxpayers' money. They can spend it any way they want. And but it's designed to discourage inmates from appealing their cases. You know, when other inmates, see, God, he's been locked up for 49 days and he went, and he came back and he still lost. Why do I need to even bother? So it's just part of the part of the process.
And in the book, which we're not going to discuss too much now because we are in a couple of weeks, you said something so powerful that after all of this and solitary on the trip, that at some point you didn't quite remember why you were there. That the mind had been dazed by the horror of the experience.
Well, I knew.
You don't know what's going to hit people when you write it.
I knew who had done it and why. I knew that I had been targeted by Karl Rove and Karl Rove's political machine in Alabama. Rove, just a quick trip down memory lane. After the Bush-Quayle debacle in 92 when they lost to Clinton, two guys that were involved in the Bush campaign, Karl Rove and a guy named Billy Canary, left Washington and came to Alabama, married Alabama girls. Rove settled in a place called Rosemary Beach on the Gulf Coast, and Canary stayed in Montgomery with his wife, who was working as a prosecutor.
This is our next talk, Governor.
Okay,
we're not going to give that away
team,
now.
That's the team that put me in jail. But so I knew who had done it and why. But
Our next talk is going to be about that whole conspiracy. Before I lose you, I have a deeply personal question I want to ask you. You were governor, you were lieutenant governor, you were secretary of state, you were attorney general, and then you became a prisoner for several years. When you were governor, every room you walked into, that's why people were there. You were the center of attention. You were the focus. And being an inmate might be the antithesis of that. How does Don Siegelman, governor, emotionally, intellectually, physically, become an inmate after you weren't just a citizen, you weren't just a guy on the street, you were the reason why people were wherever they were?
Well,
that's an essay question, I know.
I identify with people. I hug homeless people. I love people. And so being in prison, I identified with those people around me. I never felt that I was any better than any of the least of these, I got on my hands and knees and scrubbed the corners of the building, and just like the other inmates. And, I also understood that this is just a game they play, trying to break people, put them in a state of numbness where they just exist and are herded like cattle from one, chute to the other. And,
that's the point. You're saying their purpose is to break people. That's the evil of the prison system, because as a taxpayer, I would hope that people who might have committed crimes, might have, when they come out, would be less angry, more capable of functioning in society. So instead of breaking them down while we have them in our custody, why aren't we building them up? That's, of course, the fundamental question about the evils.
And the Fortune Society picks up where the prison has failed. And that
and shouldn't have to.
It shouldn't have to. The Fortune Society should be a model adopted by the FBOP in every prison and every jail in the country. What you're doing is what should be going on in every one of these lockups. You know, if we don't give these men and women the skills they need to exist when they come out, what choice do they have but to go back in? So it makes no sense. So if anybody out there is connected to the FBOP or anyone who makes decisions like Bill Barr or others, you know, for goodness sakes, pay attention to the Fortune Society and what you guys are doing. I'm quite impressed. I look forward to discussing that with you too sometime.
Governor, when this whole virus thing ends, you have to come to New York and spend some time with us, because we would love to have your input and for you to see the miracles that happen every day up at the Fortune Society. I thank you so much for joining us this morning. We're going to go out. We're going to be talking with you in a few weeks again, and maybe again and again. And
well, can I give a shout out to Bob Abrams and his wife?
By all means, yes. The former Attorney General of New York was quite helpful for you in your case.
I just got a text message from him this morning. He and Diane are sequestered in their apartment, and we wish you guys well. Stay safe, everyone, and we love everybody. Everybody.
Now, you and I talked about what should the outgoing music be, and here's. You won't be able to hear it, but I decided on Joan Baez singing Heaven Help Us All. And that's what we'll be
hearing now. Thank you so much,
Governor.
Heaven help the child who never had a home. Heaven help the girl who walks the streets alone. Heaven help the roses as the bombs begin to fall. Heaven help us all. Heaven help the black man if he struggles one more day. Heaven help the white man. Heaven help the people with their backs against the wall. Heaven help us all. Heaven help us all. Heaven help us all. Heaven help us, Lord, hear our call when we help us all. Heaven help the boy who won't reach 21. Heaven help the man who gave that boy a gun. Heaven help the man who kicks a man who has to crawl. Heaven help us all. Troubled world, I pray the Lord to keep. Hatred strikes from the mighty and the mighty from the small. Heaven help us all.
The legendary Joan Baez. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 listener sponsored radio in New York City. That's 99.5 FM in New York City. And we'll be talking with Governor Don Siegelman again in a few weeks when his book is out, and you'll be able to get copies. And I want to tell you, when I read it, it's a horror story, because one of the things that really terrified me during the last presidential election was the cries of lock her up from the Trump people. And I thought, we argue with our opponents in politics. We don't lock them up. That's what we thought banana republics and fascist dictatorships did. But when we have Don Seligman back and talk about the case and what Rove and others conspired to get him locked up where no crime is committed, I was frightened for our democracy, because I found this story in the early 2000s, this century, a precursor to what I fear is happening in the Trump regime. And we've been going back and forth, he and I, talking about all of this, and I'm looking forward to meeting him. And one of the things that I found interesting, he had been listening to WBAI down in Birmingham. If you want to support listener-sponsored radio, you can call this morning, and they'll take your call, 516-620-3602. You might want to become a buddy, pledge $15, and make that a $15 pledge every month. So $15, as I will say over and over again, to the point of boredom, that it may not seem like a lot on your little, as you get your diners club. Diners Club doesn't exist anymore, does it? Your Amex or your Visa or MasterCard. But if 10 or 12 people today pledged $15 and it came every month, and next week another 10 or 15 and we get 500 people, it makes it possible for us to be on the air and to find out that somebody like this Governor Siegelman, who is really at the forefront in the battle to save the democracy, he went through he did basic training on the Saving Democracy campaign that we are part of. We're part of his movement, and he is part of ours. We're going to play some Harry Connick Jr. and then some lighter stuff, okay, Harry? It's not exactly a pick-me-up number, but I like it.
Well, I'm working in a gold mine, going down.
Roy Connick Jr., lively number by Alan Dusant and Lee Dorsey. Don Siegelman book is called Stealing Our Democracy. It's not going to be published till June, and we'll be talking to him. I don't know if you can order it by Amazon now. You wouldn't get it now, but I don't know if you want to pre-order. It's titled Stealing Our Democracy, and the subtitle is How the Political Assassination of a Governor Threatens Our Nation. And when you read this book, you will... it's chilling. I yelled out loud a couple of times, frightened for our concept of our flawed democracy. All right, on a lighter note, I have been watching TCM. I told you I saw this wonderful Harry Belafonte Zero Marcel movie called Angel Levine. But this came up, and I want to share it with you because I'll get some annoyed people. I'll annoy someone with it. By the way, talking about it, annoying people, if you want to email me about anything, God knows I have the time, drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. Let me start all over. drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. I'm enjoying getting emails from, when you're not confined to your house 23 hours a day, you rush in and you think, I don't know if I have time. I have time to answer now. Anyway, when I was watching TCM, and they were promoting something by Greta Garbo, and I said out loud to myself, I don't get it. I never have. I know she was an icon and considered one of the greats of the screen and one of the great beauties, attractive woman, a fairly competent actress. I never got the message. And I thought, now, who are the other people that are icons that when I say I don't like them, people sneer at me? So I started making a list of those who, when they're announced on television, I groan. And then I started making a list of the people, if I hear that one of their movies is on, I will watch. So here's the icons that I've never quite gotten. Garbo is one. Don't throw things at me. I'm entitled to my opinion. Jimmy Cagney, Gary Cooper, John Wayne, James Dean, the Marx Brothers, Kirk Douglas. I Love Lucy. She was always lying. Greer Garson. She's so noble. She won an Oscar for Mrs. Miniver. I always thought she won World War II. Renee Zellweger, Alan Ladd, sorry, Barbara, and Bing Crosby. And they never reach me. Now, who are the people who, if I see on television, like I said, there was a whole evening of Harry Belafonte. I watched. Woody Allen, two movies on. I know I'm not supposed to like him. I love his movies. Chaplin, Judy Dench, Denzel Washington, the Ritz brothers. They're hardly ever on, but if I have a clue, I'll watch. Harry Ritz, funniest man I ever saw. De Niro, Jack Nicholson, Meryl Streep. No surprises in these, but these are people that get to me. Sophia Loren, Sally Field, Betty Davis, Spencer Tracy. Those were the two when I was a kid, the epitome of Hollywood and what being an actor was, Betty Davis. Spencer Tracy, Barbara Stanwyck, Paul Muni, Brando, Rita Hayworth, glamour personified, Doris Day, Cary Grant, Ingrid Bergman, Audrey Hepburn, Emma Thompson, Viola Davis, Monty Clift, Elizabeth Taylor, beauty personified, Lily Palmer, the Nicholas Brothers. Remember as kids when you saw a 20th Century Fox movie and they came leaping out. How wonderful. We waited for the Nicholas Brothers. Julie Harris, Al Pacino, Forrest Whitaker, Laurence Olivier, Fred Astaire, Eve Arden, Don Cheadle, Maggie Smith, Tom Hanks, Daniel Day-Lewis, Joanne Woodward, Toshiro Mifumi, and why not Judy Garland and Gloria Graham. Them's the folks I liked. There's probably others I missed. Here's Peggy Lee with our final musical selection. Let me just check the time. I have New York one on with no sound on television, and I can see the time that it's 9:50. So we have time for Peggy Lee, and then I'll say goodbye and till next week. Peggy Lee.
If dreams come true, I'll be with you.
Goodman wrote that song, and Peggy Lee sang it. Add Ruby Dee to that list of people who reach me emotionally as well as appreciating their actors. There are other actors who I watch with fascination, but they don't get to me. I love watching Joan Crawford and Loretta Young movies, but I don't buy them. I just find them almost caricatures and find them amusing. I gather Sean, that our friends from On the Counter are next.
Yes.
And who are we going to hear from?
Sophia.
Ah, good. All right. So stay tuned for our friends from On the Count. And are we ready to sign off? You can email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. I can't see what time it is. So on that professional note, I will announce that it's 9:54. I will talk slowly like the guys, like Bob and Ray in the Slow Talkers Conference, and say, I will be with you next week. Carly Simon saying goodbye for us.
Say goodbye. I die a little. Goodbye. I wonder why a little. Why the gods above me, who must be in the know, think so little of me. They allow you to go. And when you're near,
much do you think it costs to run a one-hour WBAI program four times a month?
I really have no idea.
Well, what do you think?
Four times a month, maybe $2,000.
So, it actually costs $833 a month. $208 per hour, $833 a month. That's why we need your support. Please go to your smartphone and message 41444 and enter WBAI. Again, on your smartphone, if you can text 41444 and enter WBAI, you can become a WBAI listener sponsor, a WBAI buddy. And thank you.
I'm New York State Labor Commissioner Roberta Reardon. New York is at the epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic, and many businesses are bearing the brunt. We know that means thousands of New Yorkers' livelihoods are at risk. If you've tried to file for unemployment recently, you may have experienced long wait times on our phones and website. You can help reduce the load on our system by only filing for unemployment on the day of the week that matches your last name. It's important for you to know that every New Yorker who's eligible for unemployment insurance will receive every cent they are owed, even if you file late.
If you are filing a new unemployment insurance claim, the day the New York State Labor Department says you should apply is based on the first letter of your last name. A through F file on Monday from 8 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. G through N file on Tuesday. O through Z files on Wednesday. If you missed your day, file on Thursday, Friday, or Saturday. The phone number to file for unemployment insurance benefits is 1-888-209-8124. Again, 1-888-209-8124. You can also file online. Go to labor.ny.gov. This is a public service announcement from WBAI New York.
Thanks to you.
Thank you for thinking of me.
And I thank you.
And I thank you.
Let me say thank you to all you people out there.
I want to thank each and every one of you for coming by.
And while he's thanking those folks, let me take this opportunity to thank all of you, our listeners and support staff, our contributors, our interns, the volunteers, producers, and the entire crew that works countless hours to bring WBAI into your lives.
Once every 10 years, America mounts a census and attempts to count every single person living in the country, citizens and non-citizens, immigrants, documented and undocumented alike. This is an extremely difficult goal, even under ideal circumstances. And even as the actions of the current U.S. government has created fear and uncertainty that all but ensures that many immigrants will stay in the shadows, too terrified to risk contact with any governmental official, census takers included. However, by law, namely Title 13 of the U.S. Code, the Census Bureau cannot release any information about you, your business, or your immigration status to law enforcement. So step out of the shadows.